are you arguing then that strict scrutiny should apply here?
No, the normal scrutiny should apply.
Welcome to A Rational Basis Review, the podcast that introduces, analyzes, and contextualizes some of the foundational constitutional law cases and issues that form the basis of the first-year constitutional law curriculum. Just because constitutional law might seem irrational doesn't mean you can't or don't understand it. We're here to help with that. We're your hosts. I'm Leah Littman, an assistant professor of law at the University of Michigan.
And I'm Melissa Murray. I'm the Frederick I. and Grace Stokes Professor of Law at NYU.
And I'm Kate Shaw. I'm a professor of law at Cardozo Law School in New York City.
Today's show covers an increasingly important topic in constitutional law, animus, and specifically its relationship to the traditional tiers of equal protection review. As you all know, under the equal protection analysis, laws that classify on the basis of a suspect category, i.e. laws that classify on the basis of race, national origin or alienage, are subject to strict scrutiny. Those that classify on the basis of a quasi-suspect classification, gender and illegitimacy, are subject to intermediate scrutiny. All other classifications are subject to rational basis review, the most deferential standard of review. And the paradigmatic case on this point is Williamson versus Lee Optical, in which the court considered a challenge to an Oklahoma law that permitted only licensed eye care professionals, ophthalmologists and optometrists, to fit lenses for glasses. Unlicensed opticians sued, arguing that the law treated the two groups differently in violation of the Constitution. Obviously, licensed professionals versus unlicensed professionals is not a suspect or quasi-suspect category, so the court reviewed the challenged law under rational basis review and concluded that it was rationally related to a legitimate state purpose. No constitutional problem.
And that's typically how things go when the court is presented with legislation that makes distinctions between different groups, so long as the distinctions are not one of those suspect or quasi-suspect classifications, then rational basis review applies and the law is typically upheld, except when it's not. In October term 1972, the court took up U.S. Department of Agriculture versus Moreno, a challenge to an amendment to the Food Stamps Act. The Food Stamps Act initially made eligible for the food stamps program a group of related or non-related individuals who are not residents of an institution or boarding house, but are living as one economic unit, sharing common cooking facilities, and for whom food is customarily purchased in common. The challenged amendment, however, redefined the term household so as to include only groups of related individuals, rendering ineligible for participation in the program any household whose members are not all related to one another.
So the plaintiffs in Moreno were members of groups of individuals who were denied food stamps because the groups included members who were not related to one another. For example, one plaintiff, a 56-year-old diabetic woman, lived with, shared common living expenses with, and received medical care from another woman with three children, each woman receiving a small monthly income from public assistance. Another plaintiff, an indigent married woman with three children, took in a 20-year-old girl who was unrelated to them because they felt that she had emotional problems. Another plaintiff, whose daughter had an acute hearing deficiency and required special instruction in a school for the deaf, decided that to make the most of her limited resources, she would share an apartment near the school with another woman, each woman being a recipient of public assistance. By excluding them from eligibility from the food stamps program, they argued the government was compounding their poverty.
We raise all of this history around the plaintiffs because it's worth noting that throughout the 1960s, the court took up a number of cases related to poverty or socioeconomic class. So think about Griffin versus Illinois, which is about the indigent's right to transcripts, or Gideon versus Wainwright, which is about the right to counsel in criminal cases. There was some suggestion during this period that the court was flirting with the idea of making wealth, poverty, and class the basis of a new suspect or quasi-suspect classification. Remember, this was the heyday of the Warren Court.
But back to Moreno. The federal government argued that because related versus unrelated households was not a suspect classification, the challenged amendment was subject to rational basis review. On this ground, the government argued, the amendment and the restriction of eligibility to related households was merely intended as an anti-fraud measure. This was a pretty good argument, and under rational basis review, it would have carried the day. Preventing fraud is certainly a legitimate governmental purpose, and while the fit between the classification, related versus non-related households, and the objective preventing fraud is pretty loose, at rational basis review, that just doesn't matter. The problem for the government was that although there was little legislative history to indicate the intended purpose of the unrelated person amendment, the legislative history that did exist showed that it was intended to prevent hippies and hippie communes from participating in the food stamp program. Those darn dirty hippies.
And Justice William Brennan, writing for the majority, seized upon this smoking gun in the legislative record. So as he explained, the government's anti-fraud rationale was duplicative. The law itself already had provisions intended to prevent fraud in the program. Instead, what seemed really to be at work was a desire to keep a politically unpopular group, and one that had been critical of the federal government on a number of fronts, from participating in the program. According to Brennan, if the constitutional conception of equal protection of the laws means anything, it must at the very least mean that a bare congressional desire to harm a politically unpopular group cannot constitute a legitimate government interest. With that, the idea of animus, a bare desire to harm a politically unpopular group, was born, and traditional rational basis review got a little more bite. Again, the idea is that a desire to harm a group can never constitute a legitimate governmental interest.
So with Moreno, the court avoided the question of whether to denominate class or poverty as a suspect class, but nonetheless got at the heart of the discrimination at issue by calling it animus, or noting that the government's actions were underlaid with this animus toward a politically unpopular group. Now, fast forward to 1985, Cleburne versus Cleburne Living Center. There, the Cleburne Living Center had petitioned the city to build a group home for individuals with cognitive disabilities. The city denied the permit request, citing a number of reasons, including concerns about the negative response from surrounding property owners, classic NIMBY concerns. They also cited the proposed building's location that would be near a high school. They feared that students would tease the residents. They also observed that the facility would be located in the floodplain. Note for most people who are outside of Texas, lots of buildings in Texas are located in floodplains. And finally, the city noted concerns about who would bear legal responsibility for the actions of the group home's occupants.
The Cleburne Living Center challenged the denial of the permit on the ground that what was really going on was that the city of Cleburne didn't want a group home for the cognitively disabled in that neighborhood. In making the claim of discrimination, the Living Center also argued that disability should be considered a quasi-suspect class, subject to intermediate scrutiny. At this time, however, the composition of the court was quite different from the court's days under Chief Justice Earl Warren, and there was considerably more anxiety among the justices about the prospect of expanding the ranks of suspect and quasi-suspect classifications. In fact, some justices openly worried that adding new suspect classifications would result in balkanization among the American people.
So in trying to decide whether to denominate disability a suspect or quasi-suspect class, the Cleburne Court identified a framework for determining whether suspect or quasi-suspect class status was appropriate. What united groups that enjoyed suspect or quasi-suspect class status was, one, an immutable trait or characteristic, and one that wasn't relevant to the individual's ability to contribute to society; two, a history of discrimination; and three, an inability to protect themselves in the political process. With those criteria in mind, the Cleburne Court concluded that the disabled did not qualify for suspect class status. In particular, the court noted that the disabled had fierce advocates lobbying on their behalf at all levels of government. It pointed specifically to the debate over the ADA. Importantly, however, the court seemed unwilling to give a free pass to the city, whose rationales for denying the building permit were incredibly problematic. Indeed, according to the court, the city's rationales and its actions evinced animus toward the cognitively disabled. Relying on Moreno, the court invalidated the city's actions and concluded that there was no legitimate state purpose behind the city's action, and instead, the denial of the permit was motivated by discriminatory animus.
The questions that underlay Cleburne, whether and how to expand the ranks of suspect and quasi-suspect categories, grew even more pronounced as the court began to consider discrimination against sexual minorities in the 1990s. Many gay rights advocates argued that sexual orientation should be treated as a suspect or quasi-suspect class and entitled to more rigorous judicial scrutiny. The court took the question up in Romer versus Evans, a challenge to Amendment 2, a voter initiative that amended the Colorado state constitution to prohibit any state or local entity from extending that what the amendment termed quote-unquote special rights to lesbian, gay, or bisexual persons. Importantly, the amendment arose as a backlash to anti-discrimination protections that had been enacted at the municipal level in liberal-leaning cities like Boulder, Denver, and Aspen. The amendment was approved by a 53-47 vote. According to a public opinion survey, Coloradans strongly oppose discrimination based upon sexual orientation, but at the same time, they opposed what they saw as affirmative action based on sexual orientation as well.
When the case reached the Supreme Court, there were two issues to be decided. One, whether to extend suspect or quasi-suspect class status to gay, lesbian, and bisexual persons, and two, whether Amendment 2 constituted unconstitutional discrimination against these groups. Not surprisingly, given its concerns about expanding the range of suspect classifications, the court, in an opinion written by Justice Kennedy, declined to denominate LGB persons a suspect or quasi-suspect classification here. So the classification is subject only to rational basis review. Colorado argued that it had a legitimate interest in ensuring that LGB persons aren't subject to special rights or preferential treatment under state law. Justice Kennedy doesn't really engage with the state's purported rationale or its arguments for what might be legitimate interests. Instead, he pulls a move that is reminiscent of Moreno.
As Justice Kennedy explained, Amendment 2 was undergirded by animus, that is, the bare desire to harm a politically unpopular group against the LGB community. And such animus can never serve a legitimate state interest. To support the view that animus actually underlay the amendment, Kennedy pointed to the amendment's breadth, noting that it not only removed existing protections from sexual minorities, but prevented the state and its localities from ever protecting those groups. Here's Justice Kennedy reading his opinion in the case from the bench.
The primary rationale the state offers for Amendment 2 is respect for other citizens' freedom of association, and in particular the liberties of landlords or employers who have personal or religious objections to homosexuality. Colorado also cites its interest in conserving resources to fight discrimination against other groups. The breadth of the amendment is so far removed from these justifications Colorado offers for it that we find it impossible to credit them. We cannot say that Amendment 2 is directed to any identifiable legitimate purpose or discrete objective. It is a status-based enactment divorced from any factual context from which we can discern a relationship to legitimate state interests. It is a classification of persons undertaken for its own sake, something the Equal Protection Clause does not permit. We must conclude that Amendment 2 classifies homosexuals not to further a proper legislative end, but to make them unequal to everyone else. This Colorado cannot do. A state cannot so deem a class of persons a stranger to its laws. Amendment 2 violates the Equal Protection Clause, and the judgment of the Supreme Court of Colorado is affirmed.
The majority's decision prompted a fiery dissent from Justice Scalia, who noted that this did not look like traditional rational basis review. More importantly, he argued, Romer and its finding of animus had sneakily undercut the logic of an earlier case, Bowers versus Hardwick, which upheld criminal prohibitions on sodomy. Here's a clip of Justice Scalia reading his dissent from the bench.
The case most relevant to the issue before us today is not even mentioned in the court's opinion. In Bowers versus Hardwick, decided 10 years ago, we held that the Constitution does not prohibit what virtually all states had done from the founding of the Republic until very recent years, namely, making homosexual conduct a crime. That holding is a given in the present case. Respondents did not urge the overruling of Bowers. But obviously, if it is constitutionally permissible for a state to make homosexual conduct criminal, surely it is constitutionally permissible for a state to enact other laws merely disfavoring homosexual conduct.
Meaningfully, Justice Scalia also argued that Kennedy and the majority were mistaking legitimate dissent for unconstitutional animus. Here he is again, reading from the bench.
The court's opinion contains grim, disapproving hints that Coloradans have been guilty of animus, or, quote, animosity, toward homosexuality, as though that has been established as un-American. Of course, it is our moral heritage that one should not hate any human being or class of human beings. But I had thought that one could consider certain conduct reprehensible, murder, for example, or polygamy, or even cruelty to animals, and could even exhibit animus towards such conduct. Surely that is the only sort of animus at issue here. Moral disapproval of homosexual conduct, the same sort of moral disapproval that produced the centuries-old laws that we held constitutional in Bowers.
As Justice Scalia's dissent suggests, Romer's import would extend beyond Colorado and Amendment 2. 7 years later, in Lawrence v. Texas, the court would rely on Romer in overruling Bowers and invalidating criminal sodomy laws. Romer would also be cited in United States v. Windsor and would pave the way for Obergefell v. Hodges, which recognized that the right to marry included the right to marry a person of the same sex.
So animus is an incredibly powerful concept. It is one that can support gay rights, but it can also be deployed in ways that may impede upon the rights of LGBT persons. So in 2018, the court took up Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado, the famous cake shop case. The case dealt with Masterpiece Cake Shop, a bakery in Lakewood, Colorado, which refused to provide a wedding cake to a gay couple based on the owner's religious beliefs. The Colorado Civil Rights Commission, evaluating the case under the state's anti-discrimination law, the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act, found that the bakery had discriminated against the couple and issued specific orders for the bakery. Following appeals within the state that affirmed the commission's decision, the bakery took its case to the United States Supreme Court.
The case pitted the interests of religious liberty and free speech against countervailing interests in LGBTQ equality. However, in deciding the case, the court actually avoided dealing with those questions about whether religious liberty or free speech would trump equality in such a clash. Instead, Justice Kennedy, writing for the court, punted a little. And his punt, spoiler alert, relied on animus. Rather than deciding the ultimate question, Justice Kennedy noted that in hearing the case, the Colorado Human Rights Commission, the administrative state tribunal below, had evinced animus against the baker, Jack Phillips, casting aspersions on his religious beliefs. Here's a clip of Justice Kennedy reading his opinion from the bench.
The delicate question of when the free exercise of religion must yield to an otherwise valid exercise of state power needed to be determined in an adjudication in which religious hostility on the part of the state itself would not be a factor in the balance the state sought to reach. That requirement was not met here. When the Colorado Civil Rights Commission considered the case, it did not do so with the religious neutrality that the Constitution requires.
Justice Kennedy specifically took issue with the statements that some of the commissioners had made while hearing the claim. One commissioner observed that religion had been used to justify slavery and the Holocaust, while another commissioner had expressed dismay at the prospect of using religion to hurt others. Justice Kennedy took a dim view of both of these statements.
The expressions of hostility toward religion and the disparate treatment this case received were inconsistent with the official neutrality that the Free Exercise Clause requires of all government officials and institutions.
In the written opinion, Justice Kennedy also noted that in other cases involving claims against bakeries that had refused to put anti-gay messages on cakes, the commission had found no discrimination. All of this, Justice Kennedy concluded, made clear that in considering Jack Phillips' case, the commission had evinced impermissible animus against the baker and his religious views.
For our purposes, the trajectory from Moreno to Masterpiece makes clear how powerful the concept of animus has been in modern equal protection doctrine. It has been a way for the court to expand constitutional protection to particular groups without having to broaden the categories of suspect and quasi-suspect classes already protected under equal protection's traditional regime. But in doing so, it's also clear that the concept of animus is quite malleable. And as Masterpiece Cake Shop suggests, it may be deployed by an even wider range of groups. And so going forward, expect to see how animus again figures into how we think about equal protection and the question of discrimination before the courts.
That's all for this episode. Thanks to our producer, Melody Rowell. Thanks to Gabriel Kahane for our music. If you'd like to learn more about current issues in the Supreme Court, check out our Supreme Court-focused podcast, Strict Scrutiny.